Hello, Joe. We're back. How you doing?
Just another perfect day here, and California is burning to a crisp, but it's nowhere near me, and I'm sorry for all of the fires and close by, but maybe our conversation will catch fire, Tim.
Oh, yeah, let's hope for the best out there. It's pretty bad. But yeah, every few years, it seems to happen out there, right? I mean,
yeah, it's... you know, I mean, California is, you know, a desert, and you get, we had a wet year last winter, and so there's lots of dry shrubs.
Yeah, yeah, conditions are ripe for it.
Once it goes, it just basically, the fire just goes depending on the wind,
and it's only tragic, only a problem if you build around there, yeah.
Right, exactly,
like,
yeah.
Hurricanes are a big problem because of beachfront property.
Yeah, that's what we got.
So, tonight, our, if I do my math right, I think today is our 21st show.
It is, yeah.
Powers and principalities and powers, or powers and principalities. That means we're now officially old enough to drink.
Thank God.
So we'll binge drink tonight.
Yep.
Like all 21-year-olds should do, right? Once they reach the age of 21. okay, so, tonight, you want to talk about... British Freemasonry, Palmerston, and its role in Zionism and perhaps Jewish power in general, the role of the British Empire the role of Freemasonry in the British Empire and its connection to Zionism. So how do you want to kick this off?
Well, if it's okay, I wanted to just give an overview.
Okay.
Zionism actually comes from Britain. It really wasn't something that came from and from British Freemasons. It really didn't start with Herzl or the group that surrounded him. It was just the opposite. He actually came in the flow of activity that came from what can be called the British Freemason Zionists. The first one, the best known, would be Lord Palmerston. And this was in the 1840s. And he made a statement that the Jews desired to return to their homeland. And as a number of Jewish scholars of the era have pointed out, this was news to the Jews. They hadn't heard of this. They were actually pretty well integrated. Anti-Semitism, as you know, the violent kind of dialectic that you see in World War II, and to some extent right after World War I, that hadn't been constructed yet, and that was another one of the things that was developed by this group that wanted to return Jews to the homeland. And then after this strange statement by Palmerston, which got a lot of attention, I'm going to give just a broad overview because I want to get to a certain point that I think is I wanted to just mention, and then we can come back and kind of fill in the details in any way you want. But so the royal family came on board, and the Duke of Kent, shortly after Palmerston's statement, he made a trip to Palestine. He went down with a group. It was Prince Edward, and it was in 1860. Okay, and so he went down. The prince went down, and he went down with a whole group of basically Zionist propagandists who were right out of Oxford and Cambridge, and this group that had went with the prince would end up writing books like you know, Sinai and Palestine and the history of the Jewish church. And then in that collection of works that came out was the very important book, War in Jerusalem, by Moses Hess. So Hess's book, which is sometimes seen as the beginning of Zionism, because Hess said that the hour had struck for the return of the Jewish race to Palestine. Hess really had just been swept up in the desire that the British Freemason expressed more than a decade before, and was clearly in motion when the prince and his entourage went to Palestine in the 1860s. And you have to remember, at this time, Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire. You know, the British had no control of it, obviously. But 3 years after the prince's trip, suddenly the British Foreign Office began preparing Palestine for resettlement. And they created a thing called the Palestine Exploration Fund. Now, this was funded by the Grand Lodge of Freemasonry, the Grand Lodge in London, right? So they paid for this. And of course, Palmerston was, you know, he was expressing the Masonic position. I mean, Palmerston was the head of the Freemasons in the Orient. He, you know, was one who led the gunboats against the Chinese to force them to take opium. And that was a Masonic project. And so they created this, basically this resettlement, even though there was no Zionism that was really in motion among European Jews. But somehow they had it that this was going to be something that they needed to get done. And this organization basically hired this guy, Charles Warren. And he went there and started to dig. And he actually said that, and the reason why they were doing the digging is that they wanted basically to discover Israel. It's not well known or understood by people, but the reason why that the Palestine Exploration Fund and the excavation by the Freemason Charles Warren was done was because there really wasn't any archaeologic evidence of Israel. And they wanted to find some. And that's what they were trying to do. They were digging, trying to find basically the antiquities of Israel. And Warren came up with the idea that the East Trading Company would basically finance introducing the Jews, pure and simple, who would eventually occupy and govern the country. And he claimed, and this is in 1875, and this is before any of the Zionism has ever even hit European newspapers or pamphlets, he said that the country should achieve a population of 15 million. So this is really weird stuff, because it looks like the Masons have simply taken on this project of creating the State of Israel. Now, as you go forward, the group that comes out of the lodge that Warren created, because Warren, when he returned, set up what was called Quattro Coronati, which is the Freemasons, it's called the Research Lodge. Basically, it's just to do historical research, purportedly into Masonry. But since Masonry is so entangled with the Israel and the Temple of Solomon, it's kind of the same thing. It's a research lodge that's basically doing a lot of kind of research into the antiquities in Judea. But this lodge, it produced not only research into Israel and produced, you know, a steady stream of Zionist propaganda, the idea that the Jews need to return to this land because the Bible says it so, right? I mean, Warren is coming across as a Christian, and he's saying, you know, you need to fulfill the role in the Bible. The Jews are supposed to go back, and then there will be a war, and then Jesus will return. So this was the basic idea that Christians were being told. What the Masons believed is not clear. I mean, they're a secret society. They're not, you know, letting people know about their position. But the Palestine and Jewish restoration cult operations also produced the Theosophy Society. In other words, if you look at the individuals involved in the production of it, they all are, you can trace them right back into the Quattro Coronati, which means the four crowns. What you get is all kinds of occultism. You have Isis, you know, you've got Kabbalah. And there's two other agencies that basically immediately come from this Theosophy Society, and this is the Golden Dawn group and the Temple of Hermetic Students of the Golden Dawn and OTO. So, you know, you've had this kind of strange idea of the occult coming out of being promoted. And it's completely clear that they're trying to promote the occult because at the same time, people from this organization are trying to reintroduce the philosophy of astrology. So you can see that the occult, for some reason, is very important, you know, in the group that is basically promoting Zionism. And now it's you get to the point where I think it there becomes like a crisis in scholarship that needs to be resolved, is that you get these like you know, Madame Blavatsky, you know, she's basically you know, she's a Mason. There's a document indicating her, you know, degree in Masonry and her acceptance into Masonry, but she comes up with you know, strange you know, kinds of philosophies, which then are taken up by Sabbatendorf, who is basically a follower of her, or at least someone who was very influenced by her. And he creates the Thule Society. Now, he's a Mason. He has a lot of bizarre occult ideas, right? And like Madame Blavatsky, his symbol is the swastika. I'm going to get into that in a second. But so the Thule Society is actually the beginning of the Nazi Party. And it's not a wavy line. I mean, they actually, you know, what becomes kind of the organization that Hitler took over is, you know, comes directly from the Thule Society. It was one of their sort of adjunct workers, attempt to organize workers. And so, you know, this seems very ironic that this line coming from the organization that produces Zionism would end up also producing the Nazi Party. Now, I mentioned the crisis of scholarship. Well, what I'm afraid of, Tim, is that both of these things were a project, and that what you're seeing is the creation of dialectic, right? And the purpose of the dialectic would be to exterminate Europe and to return the European Jews to Israel. Basically, that this appears to be, at least it's a, you know, it falls out logically from the information that we have. And the one of the things which, you know, this vein of research produces as a kind of a troubling data point is that the swastika is actually, and I think in the runic alphabet, it represents the letter G, right? Now, this is not good because that is also the letter which represents Freemasonry.
Yeah, yeah.
and so, you know, you have to wonder about the bizarre circumstance by which, you know, this occurs, and that when you try to piece apart these people, and it's very difficult. And this is why I call it a crisis of scholarship. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to give the impression that I've, you know, solved the riddle or I have enough data, because there's a lot of people who have walked down this path. Lyndon LaRouche, his group got a lot of information about this path, though they didn't get the idea of a false dialectic being created. They were kind of focused on Britain as the problem. But I just think that replaces one mystery with another. I mean, because then you have the question, well, who are the British? Why are they doing it? The LaRouche group thought about, you know, geopolitics and control, but I think that while that may well be true, you have to have some other explanation for something like, you know, the world wars and the creation of the Nazi Party coming right out of the same process by which Zionism sprang. So, you know, that's why I would hope that you know, our discussion tonight would encourage people to try to do research into this process to see if British Freemasonry had as a project the creation of this dialectic. Because it looks to me like they did, you see. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at, like, Theodor Herzl, for example, and you look at his connection into British Freemasonry. I'll just give you an example of like Herzl. I mean, in college and afterwards, he had the nickname of Tancred. Okay. Now, he got that from a book by Disraeli, right, who was the British Masonic prime minister and one of the proponents of Zionism, right? He wrote a novel about Tancred. Now, Tancred, the word, it's a proper noun, and it was the name of the, I believe it was the king who led the first crusade to recover the Holy Land. Right. So, I mean, this is pretty amazingly, you know, kind of foreshadowing of real events, wouldn't you say? Yeah. That Herzl had this as his nickname in high school, I mean, in college, before he supposedly was interested in Zionism. So, I mean, I just think that's preposterous. And it shows that he was, in fact, an agent long before he ever, you know, came public as a Zionist. And that he would have been under the influence of the, you know, Disraeli Salisbury group. This was the Round Table. You know, this was the Rothschild family. This was, you know, the group that basically ended up with the Balfour Declaration, mm-hmm. right? And I think if you look at the individuals around Herzl, I'm not going to go into too much of this because it'll put people to sleep, but there's just a whole collection of individuals that kind of swirled through his life, which, frankly, were all coming from the Disraeli, Palmerston, Freemason circle. Now, I'll shut up in a second. I'm just going to say that anti-Semitism is being promoted by basically the same group. If you look at the original kind of, you know, the anti-Semitism, I mean, this, it comes from both sides. The Zionists were trying to create an idea of the Jews as a separate race that had to defend themselves, because before 1850, believe me, this wasn't in motion. That's why they had to create it. That's why they needed programs to do this. There just wasn't enough anti-Semitism. The so-called Jewish problem was mainly one of integration, you know, and the Europeans really didn't have much kind of racial identity. They had ethnicities, of course, but that was basically, you know, areas of occupation and things like this. There wasn't a lot of social movement, so you didn't have a lot of friction. But the if you look at where, you know, the individuals that are starting to promote both sides of this dialectic of hatred, you can trace them both back into the same group that Herzl comes out of, the same group that the Palestinian Exploration Fund is coming from. And so this is really troubling to me, because it looks like we're living in an artificial world that, these broad historical functions are relating to some agenda of a group that has control over the political situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's there's something mysterious about British philo-Semitism if you take the received narrative. You have to kind of adopt a different analytical approach to understand it. I mean, it dates as far back as perhaps Oliver Cromwell, because he was one that petitioned by the Amsterdam Jews, this guy Manasseh ben Israel, to readmit the Jews back into England after their banishment, in, I think, in the 13th century. But then in the 19th century, I think it was an important period, because that's when you have the ascendancy of the Rothschild banking family in the early to mid-19th century. And this coincided, I think, was related to perhaps the increasing indebtedness of the British aristocracy. The cash-starved aristocracy started selling off their properties, borrowing money to maintain their luxurious lifestyle, their manor homes, things like this. So they'd gone so far in the debt by the middle 19th century to Jewish creditors that some people have concluded that the British Empire had become a wholly owned subsidiary of Jewish interest by the turn of the 20th century, and that's when you get the Russian Revolution, which is backed by London and Wall Street, and also the World Wars. And the Churchill family is a good example of these indebted British aristocracy sort of being controlled by Jewish power. I think Churchill himself was surrounded by a group called the Focus, which is a cabal of Jewish creditors who paid off his debt in the 1930s, and that's when you see him taking a stand against Hitler, changing his policies. But it can, with this type of analysis, it sounds like what are we blaming the Jews again? Is just but when you bring up an issue like Freemasonry and how it relates to Zionism and Jewish Freemasonry, B'nai B'rith, one has to ask the question: what role does Freemasonry play in the British Empire? Is the British Empire Freemasonry? Is the two same thing? And Zionism a tool of Freemasonry, of the British Empire, to achieve a strategic objective, namely access to the Middle East and Central Asian oil, because this also came along at a time when technology was developing, when the British Navy was converting from coal to oil. But then you have the issue of Jewish power itself. Has the tail begun to wag the dog here? And so that's understanding what's going on today, because prior to the Second World War, Jewish power was largely, I guess you could say, if not latent, at least underground or more covert than it is today. But in the aftermath of the Second World War with the Holocaust, and really since 1967, you've seen Jewish power come of age and sort of the eclipse of the WASP establishment here in the United States and the rise of neoconservatism. Today, now, you could say we live under a latter-day Sanhedrin, where anyone expressing an opinion critical of Tel Aviv or Hollywood, for that matter, is declared an anti-Semite and ostracized. And it's never allowed in, at least, never allowed in polite circles to consider that what is called anti-Semitism is also a natural reaction to bad Jewish behaviors, particularly Jewish organizations and with the policies they're promoting. But that's ironic, because the I think it's Chaim Weizmann, who was the first president of Israel, once said that anti-Semitism was not only natural, but it was desirable from the standpoint of Zionism. But that goes to that dialectic where they wanted the anti-Semitism to create a tribal mentality among the diaspora Jews, the assimilated Jews, to sort of resurrect this Jewish identity to facilitate this return to the Holy Land, which doesn't date to the Old Testament and God's promise. It dates to Lord Palmerston in the 1840s, as you pointed out. So it is. I mean, it really is confusing if you don't do the homework and try to take the broader picture. But yeah, it looks like everyone's being manipulated. The mass of humanity is being manipulated for the benefit of a few, which trails back to Freemasonry, I believe.
Well, it surely does. And See, I just, when I do this kind of research, what I see is there's just too much overlap between the Zionist crowd, which was Jewish financial interests and British governmental Masons, basically, you know, that led up to the Balfour Declaration, and the group that pushes Adolf Hitler into political power. They have this thing called the Cliveden Set, which is basically you've got Jewish financiers and Masonic policymakers, Rothschild, Warburg, and they were allied with, you know, groups related to like the Cecils, which incidentally include Winston Churchill. But Balfour, for example, was a Cecil from that family. And so my conjecture, because you see, I think that, you know, you need to try to explain what is the motivating centrifugal energy between the British Zionist Freemasons and the Jewish financiers, you know, that are promoting Zionism themselves. How do they stay together, right? Isn't there some basis to you know, have friction? But, you know, that's why I have said for some time that you really want to get testing of the background of both groups, probably. But you really need to have this because you've had so much basically infiltration by, you know, families that you don't really know the background of into political power. And when you end up with World War One and World War Two, and then something as bizarre as both the Zionists and the Nazis coming can be being seen to coming from the same organization, you just have to start looking for new explanations. You know, the idea that they're interested in controlling the Middle East or this is some kind of British geopolitic maneuvering. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't buy it. It just doesn't explain something as catastrophic as what we've experienced. I mean, so so unnecessary and, and so destructive, I think, to what would have been the wealth that they would have maintained if they just kept Europe intact rather than destroy it.
All that destruction, yeah.
Yeah. So you see the financial explanation, political power explanation, I don't think that makes any sense because it doesn't really explain what happened. You see, I want something that'll explain what happened. And so what could explain it is that the, you know, British Freemasons were in fact, or at least saw themselves in some way as either ethnically or religiously allied with the Jewish financiers. And that they simply maneuvered the politicians into position in order to create what they saw as a vision in the 1840s. Because when Palmerston made his declaration, I mean, he was looking into history that had no connection into the reality he was experiencing. The Jews were not clamoring to go back to the Holy Land. They had no idea that it was even available. There just wasn't any Zionism, you see. So there has to be some explanation for something that led to such an incredible catastrophe as the World Wars, right?
And at least on one level, the Zionist project never would have been fulfilled unless there was a catastrophe in Europe, particularly one targeting Jews.
Yeah, that's right. You see, and this shows how deep and how committed this organization may be, is that because if you look at into how they talk about, well, how are you going to get the Jews to go to Israel, right? This was a real problem in the 19th century. And they were saying that, you know, they will go because they'll be oppressed. You know, they were actually there. There wasn't any kind of question about how they were going to get them there. There was going they kind of alluded to it. But I mean, they talk about anti-Semitism as being something that's, you know, very important in the whole process. So, you know, if this kind of train of thought is coherent, if I'm going into, you know, like an actual understanding of our history, what I'm seeing is the Masons and the Jewish financiers basically had an idea of reestablishing Israel. And this would make a lot of sense when you look at the Masonic, you know, kind of focus on the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple, right?
Yes, right, which, from what I understand, has been attempted a couple times.
Yeah. Yeah.
Been frustrated by strange happenings.
Right, exactly. You've got to be... So there's something strange there, but...
Yeah, Julian the Apostate. Now that, yeah,
his attempt, yeah, it's a... It's a secret society. No one can really pretend to know, you know, the deepest parts of Masonry. If you want, you know, my take, I attempt to decode Catcher in the Rye, and it's on Post Flaviana, a website, and people can read it, you know, my impression of it, which is not good. I see Freemasonry having a very violent secret at its core and being a really secret organization at these high levels. And so... you know, I just think that we need it's sort of like the kind of the informed speculation that I think is justified, say, in terms of American politicians. You know, the idea that the Bush family, they're related into the secret society, makes us we should be able to speculate. I mean, even though we don't have every detail, but because you have catastrophes like the counterculture and the Vietnam War, right, which we had discussed as, you know, an artificial dialectic that, you know, looked like it was psychological control designed to shatter a generation. Because we can speculate into that area, we should not be afraid to do the same kind of informed speculation just because people were hurled the charge of anti-Semitism, you see.
Yes.
So that's why, you know, when I talk about these things, I rather than to have it shut down by fear, what I hope is that people will do the basic core research and realize that this is pretty coherent.
Well, I mean, there's some academic studies in this regard, like Jessica Harlan Jacobs' book Builders of Empire, and she relates how sort of the well, Freemasonry, how it played an important part in the cohesion and maintenance of the British Empire through the lodge system. And these are organizing principles that intelligence agencies, military intelligence agencies, secret societies may use in order to achieve certain objectives. And we can see these organizing principles in like the CIA or Skull and Bones, which creates CIA. And so it is a technology or method to engage in high level, you know, criminality and malfeasance without getting exposed. And one thing that's important to know about Freemasonry itself is the Masonic vision of the world itself has been internalized so much so that it defines the modern world, that its objectives of, you know, equality, fraternity, universal brotherhood, these things. These things all sound like nice objectives, but they're very destructive, because in many ways, one thing is they're great rhetorical points, but they're also contradictory, because you can't have liberty, equality, and fraternity, because quite often fraternity violates the principle of equality. And so does liberty. Liberty violates fraternity and equality, because by nature, all things aren't equal. So, but it's a slogan. It's a political slogan. Like most political slogans, if you really examine they're internal contradictions. You know, it's like a bumper sticker or something, you know.
Yeah, but Tim, thank heavens you brought this up, because it's so important to understand that basically they're slogans that lead to world government.
That, yes, universal brotherhood, cosmopolitanism, right? It's everywhere. I mean, if you take if you're studying to be a teacher, to get your teacher's certificate, you'll have to study global citizenship. And that no one can really define what that means. I mean,
it means world government.
Yeah, where do you register to vote if you're a global citizen?
You know, it's funny. I mean, because, you know, I'm somewhat skeptical.
Somewhat, yeah.
When I hear these slogans, I automatically just replace them in my mind with world government under a dictatorship.
Yes,
because that's the only way these things can ever, you know, be achieved. And that's, this is the workers' paradise. It's another slogan, you know.
And yeah, what do you need? Land, bread, and peace, right?
Yeah. I mean, you need the Politburo. And so that's why the French Revolution was, you know, clearly not going to make things better for the French people. You were going to have Napoleon, the Masonic cesspool, come forward and take everybody to Russia and just kill off the entire nation as much as he could, right? Mm-hmm. And so you've had this series, you know, I mean, the Napoleonic Wars, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War. The stench of the secret society is everywhere in these things. When you study them, it's just everywhere. These are not, in my opinion, none of them have anything to do with anything other than population reduction. Mm-hmm. And this is the Georgia Guidestones in action, you know. That's what these things do, and that's how people should look at them. And so when you look into this trajectory, you know, and you know, like this, the relationship between these old British Masonic families that are ruling Britain and creating British geopolitics, right? With all sorts of spies and agents, and then they bring out these series of organizations, which all focus on the occult, mm-hmm. and this is where, you know, the Nazi Party comes from. You get, you have the Order of the Golden Dawn, right? You get OTO, you get eventually the Thule Society. And I think there was a process because they wanted a number of these organizations in sequence, so it would be more difficult to trace back. But if you look closely, it isn't hard to really see the relationship between British Freemasonry and like Helen Blavatsky. Because for one thing, there's a document which basically outlines how powerful she was in British Freemasonry. It's a Masonic letter to her, kind of describing her stature. And then you get her use of the swastika, right? Mm-hmm. And now this then, when Sabatendorf, the bizarre mystic, right, picks up her work, he adopts the swastika as well. And her focus on ISIS, and then all of what I see, Tim, is the occult is basically used as an obfuscation, right? It's a way that the organization just can't be penetrated very deeply because you basically have this front of like the Psychic Research Bureau or the OTO. You know, you've got Aleister Crowley, you know, he's got these bizarre rituals, you know, the public learns about these rituals. But in back of it, there's political power. And I think the occult is just being used in the same way that the slogans are used. Mm-hmm. It's just another way to make what is in back harder for the citizen to recognize.
Yeah, and organizations like the SS will pick up on this. And incorporate some of the occult practices into their rituals. And of course that helps frame the narrative about the SS. At the same time, you have figures like Aleister Crowley, OTO, who figures greatly, he was a British intelligence agent, posing as a German agent.
Right.
Fighting for Irish causes in New York during the First World War. But he influences entertainment through Hollywood and these things. And so it permeates or sort of penetrates normal society, and that works towards the degradation of society, because you have groups like Led Zeppelin and Ozzy Osbourne later in the 20th century promoting Aleister Crowley and being devotees of his practices and things like that. But back there's an interesting section here, chapter in E. Michael Jones's book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit on the Rise of Freemasonry, and it speaks to Freemason, the Masonic world. And here's a good point to pick this out. I'll start here. In January 1795, Labine Ami opened a lodge meeting by adopting the revolutionary principles of liberty, fraternity, and equality. Before opening the lodge, our beloved chairman congratulated the assembled fraternity on the long-hoped-for revolution in our dear country, because of which liberty, fraternity, and equality had now become the motto of our days, and furthermore announced to the brothers that from now on all honorary titles were held to be abolished among us. When the brothers sang the Masonic songs, La Marseillaise was the first on the list. The lodge, however, had become unnecessary because it had become the model of the new world, the modern world, which had adopted and would go on to implement its principles in its struggle against what was left of the Catholic order in Europe. That Masonic crusade would continue as the nationalist Freemasonry of the Risorgimento conquered the Papal States in Italy, and then the Masonic powers of America and England would dismember Austria, the last bastion of Habsburg's Catholic Empire, following World War I. Both Wilson and Masaryk, the first president of Czechoslovakia, the country Wilson carved out of the heart of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, were Masons. Each case, what begun on the continent as a constitutionally governed societies for gentlemen, became the microcosm for the new secular and civic yet quasi-religious political order we have now come to know simply as the modern world.
Well, that's a very keen political, you know, synopsis by Michael Jones. However, it has this question, which it, you know, is often the case, that it just seems to replace one mystery with another, because the question then becomes, well, who are the Masons? And you see, I'm positing a solution to that. I'm saying, well, what if they're basically, some families that in antiquity had a secret identity, either ethnic or religious, of being Jewish, and then that is what they use. Because, and I'll point out that in Masonry, at the Royal Arch Initiation, this has been pointed out to me by reliable sources, that part of the oath is that, you know, it says that this is for the benefit of Masons in general and the Jewish people in particular. And that's a quote from the Royal Arch Initiation Pledge. And so you get these clues that as you work your way up, you start to get an understanding of why the Temple of Solomon, rebuilding it, is of such focus to the Masons. Is that really, you know, the word Freemason, it could be, you know, like liberty, equality. It's just a front for something that wants to be hidden. And so I think that, you know, before, you know, the anti-Semitism, that dreaded sword that hangs over the head of the intrepid researcher in the modern world, is hurled at us, you know, we should point out that we're calling for more research into this. I really think that there is, in my opinion, the case is strong enough, Tim, that it is troubling. And the idea that we don't really start to focus on this just seems crazy to me.
And also the mass of the Jewish people are being set up.
They have been set up.
For periodic catastrophes, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if this is correct, you know, in part, or, you know, I mean, basically they were just played, the entire Jewish people were played like a fiddle in order to maneuver them into Israel. Anti-Semitism was actually created. If this is the case, if what I'm suggesting is correct, then the people at the top really don't care at all about anything other than these broad political structures that they're trying to achieve. And they must have, be kept in check by oaths. The only thing I can imagine that would make this possible would be oaths that have been passed down through the generations, which they basically vow to achieve the structure of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And that whatever they have to do in terms of slaughtering people is just irrelevant. That the commitment to the oath is somehow what is... you know, is all that's important to them. And I'll just point out one little point of irony, Tim. I mean, you know, Hollywood had a bad week. And, you know, you wonder if some of the attitude that exists at the top in Hollywood isn't reflective of this this perspective about humans as animals.
Yeah, they had a Lorne Michaels, the producer of Saturday Night Live, was asked about the scandal surrounding Harvey Weinstein, and he said it was a New York thing.
Yeah.
The reason why Saturday Night Live hadn't made any jokes at Harvey Weinstein's expense, why this was. Well, it's a New York thing, apparently, because although he's more of a Hollywood figure, someone, one of my internet friends pointed this out to me. Well, Harvey Weinstein's associated, maybe he hails from New York, but he's a Hollywood figure. So why is he being spared, you know, the daggers, the comedic daggers of Saturday Night Live? And, well, I think there might be something else going on here, because if I recall, Donald Trump is from New York City.
Right.
Yet.
Yeah, he does not spare. Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's so the.
So there's an ethnic component here, right?
Absolutely. And the thing is, the ethnic component ends up with the shattering of the citizen's mind, because, you know, when humor is all directed against particular groups, and other groups are spared, then, and if that conditioning exists over generations, then you really change kind of the way that people look at themselves.
Yeah, they had as also pointed out to me, there's a video of Seth MacFarlane a few years back regarding the nominations for the Academy Awards. There was a ceremony for the nominations other than the show itself, and he's announcing the actresses who are giving the best actress. And he announces the actresses, and there are four or five of them. And after he gives the names, he gives congratulations. You no longer have to pretend you're attracted to Harvey Weinstein. You're attracted to Harvey Weinstein. And the audience goes, ooh. So it was known 3-4 years ago that this guy was praying. But, you know, my point is, I think it's always been known. The casting couch, the fact that actresses have to put up with this stuff. All of a sudden now he's being singled out, when this is pervasive throughout Hollywood for young women, children, which is the bigger scandal, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, much.
That's being covered up, not being mentioned. All of a sudden, now all this outrage. But this, I mean, Hollywood is sort of a flesh industry. So the moral outrage, I don't really care much to hear at this. I think it's hypocrisy. I mean, some of these actresses, one actress what was her name? I think it's Mindy Kelly or something. She's an actress, and
she's not a relative.
No. But she claimed that she's been in a few movies and TV shows, and she claims that Harvey Weinstein made a pass at her years ago, offering to give her a big role if she were to come to his hotel room. And she artfully avoided doing it. She's nevertheless had a career, so I don't know what that means. But all these actors are coming out of the woodwork saying, yes, he did this to me. He made the same come on to me, same deal. This is the kind of stuff that actresses have to put up with in Hollywood all the time. But at the same time, I look her name up on the internet, and there she is in the color of Cosmopolitan magazine. You know, cleavage exposed, tight outfit, beautiful young woman. And because this is Cosmopolitan magazine, you know, Helen Gurley Brown and all that. And one of the headlines is, you know, four tips that will drive your man crazy, sex tips in the bedroom, all this stuff. And thinking, if you put your splatter your face on a magazine like this, dressed like that, with all these sexually, sexually obsessed headlines, are you really going to act outraged when a ugly movie producer comes on to you? I mean, is that really? Yeah. I'm like, come on.
You're benefiting from pornography on one side, and then you're saying the pornographic culture is wrong on the other.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't agree more. I mean,
my point is, he's only responding to how, well, I'm not saying I'm saying men are responding the way they're told they should respond to these things. And then they're being, oh, you pig. Well, I mean, it's like,
Well, I mean, sexual degeneracy was a Masonic project.
Yes.
Just as I'm suggesting needs to be studied in terms of Zionism and fascism. You know, and it's interesting when you put these dialectics, you know, into an analytic structure, you know, like we tried to do in sort of a preliminary crude way tonight, because in a smaller sense, you know, with like MK Ultra, the LSD culture and the Vietnam War, it's a lot easier to understand it, you know, because it's one nation and the culture when you look at something as incredible as the possible creation of the State of Israel, the creation of anti-Semitism to help bring it about, and then the creation of Nazism to be able to depopulate Europe, I mean, now that is a vast project. It's hard for people to get their head around. And so, but nevertheless, as an analytic structure, man, it's very coherent. I play with this stuff all the time, and I'm seeing a lot of these connections just make perfect sense to me. And so because of its potential, as far as being structural into our reality, this political setup, this Masonic project, I really do think that people who listen to us, man, I hope that some of them get inspired to do some research into this area, because I know you and I could use some help, I think everyone should be interested. I think this is something that it would be, it'd be great if it could be talked about. Now, I know there is this problem when you do this kind of research that people will say, well, it's coming from a bad place in the heart. But you know what I would say to that, Tim? I would say, well, really, if anti-Semitism was created by this group, don't you think a lot of Jewish people would like to know that?
Yeah, because they're being played for suckers.
Yeah, they may say, well, everything is working out great for us, and look, we have Hollywood, as people often say, it's like this Jewish-dominated media phenomena. Is that really working out great for middle-class Jewish people in America and Western Europe and things? I just think that basically the group that apparently is in charge, because of their inflexibility through this oath structure that I think has to exist, they're not even psychopaths. They're just robots, and they don't have any capacity to make any change in direction. They simply can't alter their course because they're probably basically fulfilling oaths that were generated in the first century,
mm-hmm.
And so they need to be replaced immediately. They need to be exposed immediately. So, there's some good ways to do it. Just by trying to create a DNA database would be a simple way to see if there is, at this high. And you see, looking at history like this, when you see culturally significant individuals, a lot of these guys have children, right, that are not inside the deal, obviously. That group could be used to generate the DNA database. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, cite someone as being, get his DNA. But I mean, like, say you're a famous rock and roll person that had been used by the secret society to debase culture. Well, what if you have children, right? And they're in the world and they're interested in this vein of research. They can come forward and say, look, here's my dad. And let's see, I can give you, I can help create the database. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about stealing people's identity or getting their DNA illegal. I'm just saying, I think it would be possible just with what is available, really, to start to create the database. And once it was established, and if it is pay dirt, if people can start to see, wait a second, this is actually some kind of a family structure, then it would quickly develop, and the citizen would have everything he would need to be able to make the right choices.
Yeah, we'd be remiss if you didn't mention the role of the Schofield Reference Bible in this.
Yeah, God Almighty. Yeah, the proto Zionist propaganda piece of all time.
And that was Samuel Untermeyer, I think, who bankrolled that, and that got Christian fundamentalists on board. I think that dates from a time when I think the Vatican refused to sign on to the Zionist project, and that's when they said, well, we got to work on the fundamentalists, the evangelicals, and they produced this Bible. And this is going back and just changing the Bible around to justify your cause. And Sam Altmaier, of course, big financier, he ties back in, I think, Bernard Baruch and Chaim Weizmann and these guys, same people that arranged the Balfour Declaration.
Yeah, I mean, it goes right in, exactly. That's a great point. This is just another example of how they're using religion to shape culture in the way they want, but not for any good purpose. They have nothing but genocide in mind. Remember that the Scofield Bible really begins the whole end time fascination on the part of Christians. Before that, it wasn't something that was just so, you know, motivating. I mean, now, you know, guys like James Agee, I think his name is, I mean, they talk about the end times like, you know, we've just got to bring it about immediately. And Jesus will return as soon as we can just get a few nuclear bombs set off in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm exaggerating, but you get my point, is that that there has been a manipulation of religion by this organization to basically to create a quasi-religious structure for the Middle East wars. You know, and of course, it all goes to world ruler, because even the idea of the Messiah, you know, I mean, this is... you know, the Messiah is if you look in the Dead Sea Scrolls, he's described as the world ruler. Helen Blavatsky was talking about, you know, she had the peace, love, and, you know, happiness thing, right, with the Theosophists. But then she talks about, well, really what we're really doing is preparing the return of a world ruler, right?
Yeah.
So that's the, you know, one of the clues that I think the citizen should look for, you know, with these occult groups. Is if they've got, you know, like all this like Crowley, but then it somehow links into this world ruler stuff, man, that should be your clue that, wait a second, I'm getting played here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can take off the demon suit and, you know, forget the black mask because, you know, you're just being made a fool of, and you're going to end up under the political control of someone that wants to send you to a camp.
Yeah, and this goes back to, I guess, that original split. The desire for a political Messiah as opposed to, you know, one who claimed his kingdom was not of this world.
Exactly.
You know, and so that goes, I guess, that original disagreement. That
well, you know, as I see it, even Christianity was just a mask that in back of you always had the pontiff. You know, it's a. I mean, E. Michael Jones and I maybe should have it out sometime. Interesting, you know, but I mean, you know, if you look at the role that Christianity played in the creation of the feudal system, I mean, it's not great. You can really see it was deliberately, you know, set up as mind control, where the, you know, the Caesar changed his title to Pontiff Maximus, but that was just one of his titles anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes a pope, and then Constantine, who set up the feudal system and also began the process to make Christianity state religion. When he dies, he gets the you know the remains of the 12 disciples and arranges them in a circle and then puts his grave in the middle. So he's giving you a clue as to who you think the Son of Man, you know, he thought was anyway. So, you know, the first century origins are, you know, complicated.
Yes,
you,
yeah.
You know, you read my book if you're interested in my take, but I think the feudal system is pretty straightforward, and Christianity was being used as political control.
Almost like they want to return to a feudal system, or at least a neo-feudalism.
Well, they are. Exactly, neo-feudalism. Yeah.
Without the bomb of Christianity.
well, I mean, wait a second. I mean, if you look at, like, neo-Christianity, like A Course in Miracles.
Yeah, about the CIA's involvement in that, yeah.
I mean, it's an MK Ultra production. And that really became the foundation of the whole occulted Christianity. And it's fascinating because here we are looking at how the occult is being basically added to this component, right, that's coming out of the Masonic group, which is setting up Zionism. But then they add the occult aspect just to make the transition to to Nazism, the Nazi party, a little more difficult to understand. But then, you know, you look at the neo-Christianity, right, and the channeling phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the same thing. It's just a little bit of bedazzlement so that the fact that you're transitioning into a new political structure isn't being paid attention to. You know, the humans are very easy to fool, unfortunately.
They're religious by nature, so that can be very easily manipulated.
Absolutely. And the European, oh, man, it hasn't been a great 2,000 years, buddy. I mean, you know, the feudal system and then the world wars, you know, we've had a rough time. And even though we're always told that we're somehow this elite race, I don't think so. I think if you actually look at our history, there have been, you know, a veneer of power and evil on top of us for thousands of years.
Yeah. And what you have, I think, of the dynamic with the Anglo-American Zio Empire is this is the sea power versus the continental powers. And there's two very different cultures, which is why it explains what Indo-Europeans, the Germanic peoples, were targeted, I think. And same with the Russians, you could speak, the Russian, the Orthodoxy, things like that. So there's some conflict there. Have you looked into anything? You mentioned that you sort of this rise of sort of Christian mysticism, this manipulation of religion, Course of Miracles, the sort of the '60s phenomenon of Jesus hippies, Jesus freaks.
Yeah, I actually have, and it was completely artificial.
Mm-hmm. You remember the Doobie Brothers? Jesus is just all right.
Sure, and Norman Greenbaum. Jesus is just all right with me. I mean, basically, Jesus was, and particularly the way they were presenting Jesus, right, as kind of a hippie. I mean, it was as if that was part of the these ancient religions that were using psychedelic drugs as part of their spiritual path.
Jesus
you know, was basically in on that philosophy. So I think that all of these things, that neo-Christianity, the channeling, Jesus as a hippie, I think you can look at these and are all directly related into the MK Ultra, kind of perspective that was generating enough confusion so that the people would take the drugs. You know,
you remember, inevitably when you'd be arguing politics with a hippie or a leftist back in the early 70s, some guy would say, "Hey, I know a guy who had a lot of crazy ideas. He wore sandals and had long hair."
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, it was amazing that they could, but you see, that's how we're played.
Godspell, right? Godspell, remember Godspell?
Yeah, Godsmack, and God. I mean, so they play us because they have studied us and they know what concepts are inside our mind that can be attached to, can be manipulated, and you know, it varies from time to time depending on what they want to do with us, where they want to take us, what we need to realize is that the political structure is artificial. I mean, we think, Hillary and Donald, there's a choice. And no, there's no choice. There isn't any. You know, you've got two individuals that are both being promoted by the same group. And so we don't have any political freedom.
Well, it's the same as the Patriots versus, the New York Giants or something.
It's just exactly right. It's a great, that is what it is. It's like literally, you get to watch the game and root for one side or the other, but you don't own the teams.
If fans are punching each other in the stands.
Yeah. I mean, you have the players on one knee.
Yep.
Or the Star Spangled Banner. I mean, it's pathetic.
Someone pointed out to me that Kaepernick was posing next to this little girl from Syria who supposedly wrote a book about her experience there, advocating the fall of the deposition of the Assad regime. Little Bonnet, I think Bonnet is her name. She's a cutout.
Unbelievable.
So now you have Kaepernick, who's a full, this quarterback who's become this lightning rod of criticism, posing with this faux, child activist.
Yeah.
The sports world comes together with geopolitics. It's all the same.
Yeah, everything is being unified into one cesspool of propaganda so that the wars can continue. Because, at this point, this is why our discussion is pretty timely. Because, Tim, we have eternal wars now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just never stop. There's no reason. We don't even know we're fighting any longer.
How can that be, Joe? We don't have a war department anymore. We have a defense department.
I would say if you ask the American people, well, who are we fighting? They wouldn't even have a clue.
Happened. I mean, you probably remember that during Vietnam. You lived it as a youth. But what was the home front like? It was like. going to eating hamburgers, listening to rock and roll, and you know, cruising down the strip in your gas guzzler. If you weren't off in Vietnam, and if you weren't a young man off in Vietnam, and the American people just accepted that supine, you know, the supine reaction to this ridiculous war, and they just sort of saluted, said, "We'll go ahead, go along with it," and you know, and there was no real questioning of it, and you know, of course, you had the program. I mean, there was questioning. You had the, obviously you had the, but that was designed to create the division that it created. But the point of that,
they were trying to do a kind of a double bind. You know, this is like the Bateson thing where they really wanted to drive the boomer crazy,
but the electoral process was completely incapable of coping with the issue.
Yeah,
I mean, you could vote one election and you'd vote people in, and the war would be over. It just dragged on until it kind of fizzled out, and they have achieved their objective. And they did. You know, people think we lost it. We didn't lose it. I mean, they wanted those helicopters flying off of the embassy in Saigon in 1975, and you know, all these things were kind of the division, the demoralization it created, and you know,
the shattering of the generation.
It was alchemy, social alchemy.
Social alchemy, and at the end of it, what you had was the family was destroyed.
Yes.
The family was the target. I mean, they wanted to break up the ethnic neighborhood and break up European families. Mm-hmm. And so they had both MKUltra and the crazy Vietnam War. And at the end of it, we were shattered. My generation was shattered. I told you, I came to my, the 20th high school reunion, mm-hmm. and they had a list of children, right, that we had produced. It was like... it wasn't even one-tenth of the number of people who were in the class. I mean, there was many, many components, but I'm not exaggerating. Yeah. If it was one-tenth, I would have been amazed. Because drugs, the war, feminism, you know, weaponized feminism, I mean, all of these things have taken a hit on us, and they had just stopped family production. And remember, this was the baby boomer. This was the group that was coming from middle-class families. I mean, if they had replicated at the same rate, you would have had a completely different demographic America.
That's right, because in 1964, I think I mentioned the last time, we should probably do a show in the year 1964.
Yeah, we should. That would be, because that was such a transition year.
Right after the Kennedy assassination, you have the Beatles coming in, and this creation of this sort of cacophonous rock music, which would be the soundtrack to the generation. You have Vatican II. You have the introduction of the pill. You have feminism. Man, it really was. I mean,
I was there, brother. Yeah. It was a rough time. And, there was a lot of damage to create the effect that we ended up with a generation that didn't replicate and a completely different direction for America. Mm-hmm. As I said, if the demographics had continued another iteration at the same rate, you'd have had a completely different country.
Yeah,
absolutely different. And one that the common European citizen might have had some power for the first time since, you know, Athens in the 3rd century.
That's what you were getting in the 20th century, this rise of the middle class, high savings rates and these things.
Exactly.
And they were on the reverse.
And the ethnic neighborhoods that were developing more power. I mean, you know, look at E. Michael Jones. He talks, you know, obviously does such a great job explaining all this. But yeah, I mean, they brought it to a halt and then started the process of evaporating, you know, all of these individuals. And so it just needs an explanation.
Well, I mean... It goes back to Freemasonry, because I think you also talked about the objective, sort of this approach towards drugs, the mass marketing of narcotics and drugs of the opium wars, and Palmerston and Freemasonry. Of course, that leads into Skull and Bones, and so Skull and Bones traces its the Russell Trust, which is the opium trade.
Well, you know, it's so amazing. I mean, here now we have an opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, wait a second. How many times do we have to go through this? Remember, this is how Palmerston comes basically into political power in Britain, is by leading the gunboats into China and blowing up everyone who wouldn't let the opium trade go forward.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so now here we are in 2017. And oh, my gosh. Big Pharma, which is, if you trace back, you know, the ownership of this stuff goes right to the East Asian trading companies. Mm-hmm. And once again, we have a terrible opioid epidemic. My gosh, Tim, I guess this is just circumstance. It couldn't be the hidden hand, once again, you know, affecting history, could it?
Yeah, I think it's just history unfolding.
It just unfolds, man.
Yeah.
And it always crushes the European somehow. No matter how it unfolds, it always ends up with us, you know, getting squashed. So I'm just tired of that. And I am willing to, you know, take some risk to try to change this situation. And I think that I hope people who listen to us will get the clue that we really want to, you know, create a lot of research and get this information, you know, spread through social media so that, and it's happening. You know, like I said the other day, I just based on my little sample size, I'm seeing a lot of people that are just getting tired of being frightened and tired of being intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
So this, you know, is an approach of research that I think will end up with people being more bold. You know,
let's hope. Well, Joe, I think we covered
it. Thank you so much, Tim. That was fascinating. Really interesting your take on these things. I don't know why. I'm always surprised where we end up in the conversation somehow.
Hey, I'm just a guy with a mortgage and two car payments, Joe.
Wait, I mean, thank God you're not a guy with two mortgages and a car payment.
Yeah.
I mean,
that would be,
could always get worse, you know.
That's true. That's right. So listen, Joe.
Right, great. Thank you so much.
Enjoy your weekend.
Yeah, you too. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.